Andy Heats, how is your flight? Are you a sleepy Heats?
I am a sleepy Heats. Nothing big to report about the flight, other than I somehow exited the terminal in Boston and had to go back in. I was confused, but it's fine. Everything was fine. Also, hats off to Boston Logan Airport. They have what's called a sensory calmness room, which was awesome. I hate airports. I hate that they're always blasting stuff at you. I want them to shut the fuck up. It's stressful enough. But you can go into this room, and it's just kind of calm. I think they designed it for autistic children, but I loved it. And everybody do this. Replicate Boston. And then I flew into Edinburgh at 8:30 this morning. I've just been working since then, so we'll see what happens today.
Hold on. This room that ain't got anything in it, has it got a bar?
Your sensory deprivation.
Yeah. No, but I'm sure you could get a drink and go in there, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, look, good idea. Good first draft. But we can make this better. We can work it to a 10. Right now it's at
a
6.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So you left Austin when?
I left Austin yesterday at 2 p.m.
Yesterday at 2. Okay.
Yes. And I took the overnight flight and got into Edinburgh around like 8 o'clock this morning and come to you from there now.
Oh, my God. So you're going to fall apart. You're going to slowly depend. You're going to disintegrate.
I think the question is just, how do I fall apart? Do I, like, hoping, weepy, afraid of racial epithets? Afraid that's what it is. We'll see what happens. I don't know. But either way, this is probably the end of my career.
Exactly. You didn't think that there was a hard R in Andrew Heaton until this episode.
Yeah. Sleep-deprived Heaton is the worst. But, no, I think, like, sleep-deprived Heaton plus heat and humidity would be the trifecta. As it is, sleep-deprived
even
cool
now, heat. you have the capacity. This actually makes me feel better about your mental state, is that you are still able to bring in heat and humidity into a conversation about you not getting enough sleep.
Yeah. Okay, can I tell you, and we'll probably cut this bit, I'm just like, I get, you know what, I'll talk to you about this afterwards. There's a psychosomatic thing going on right now that I'm slightly worried about. I should probably speak to a specialist about, unrelated to heat, humidity.
Come on, you have to do it. Yeah, and also I'm editing this episode, so.
Great, okay, so this I'm baffled by this and slightly unnerved by it. Not this last summer, 2023, but 2022, so like 2 summers ago, very quickly after coming to Edinburgh, I started getting rashes, and I was trying to figure it out. I was like, okay, maybe like it must be something I'm eating. No, I thought it was like laundry detergent for a while. So
sure.
I
makes sense. Yeah.
Get different laundry detergents, and that didn't do anything. And then I started sending my laundry to a laundromat. That didn't really do anything. And I could kind of keep it at bay with Benadryl, but it makes you groggy, but I could make it work. Then this last summer, I'm in a completely different location, and I started getting it again. And I was like, what is now I'm thinking it's something that I must be eating because I'm in a different place. So I was like, maybe it's Iron Brew, the Scottish soda that I drink sometimes. Like that, maybe that's it. And then today, I swear to God, as the plane touched down, I started itching. And I'm like, it has to be psychosomatic, right? Like, if I'm getting rashes the moment I get here, that has to be something fucked up in my brain, unless there's literally something in the air. But even then, it couldn't get into the plane in time. So I don't know what's going on. And I like it here. So what's happening?
Well, yeah.
Sounds like stress. Maybe you don't like it there that much.
No, maybe I don't.
I don't think it's necessarily whether you like it or don't like it. I will say I am a very big believer of psychosomatic trauma manifesting physically. It has run in my family. My mom, when she gets super stressed, has gotten skin rashes. The only time that I ever had it was when I was moving from Florida to California. It was complicated for a lot of different reasons. A, I was moving across the country. B, I was leaving working with my best friend, Andrew Main, who I had worked with since college throughout the vast majority of my 20s. So there was a lot of change, a lot of difference, a lot of unknown ahead of me, and I had a big outbreak that has never resurfaced. I've never had skin issues before. I've never had skin issues since. So I would say I don't think you need to see a doctor. I do think that maybe if you have somebody that you talk to in terms of mental health, unpacking uncertainty and a change of coming back and forth between the two continents might be a good place to delve.
Maybe
in.
So. I mean, I definitely think I should definitely talk to somebody about this mental health wise. And it's probably all those things you mentioned. I don't know. I think maybe it's like this is like alternate universe Heaton, and I come over here and glimpse what life might have been. I don't really know. But it started before I started dating Kate, too. So I don't think it's that. So
you want
to
know,
but I should probably talk to a professional.
You want
to
know what could have solved this? A bar in the sensory deprivation room of the Boston Logan Airport.
I think you're both weak. My skin's trying to straight up kill me. You get rashes. Ooh. Yeah. I have cancer, bitches. God.
Cancer privilege over here.
All right. You heard it from Jen. Mental health is bullshit. And
oh
I should man
God.
Up. Thanks, Jen.
Oh, jeez.
Yep. I had to play the card.
Cancer bully. Oh, you know, I got charged an extra $2 on my restaurant tab. Oh, really? Right. Tell that to my cancer.
Yep. Walk off mental health, gang. Walk off mental health. It's just weak. If you have mental health
exactly.
issues.
Just cut it off, you know, like Jen's cancer.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Just chop off all your skin, Andrew. You'll be fine.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young. Joining me in studio
is Jen Briney.
And from Edinburgh, Scotland, you thought he was just here. No, he's back over there. Now you see him, now you don't.
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We're going to be talking about Argentina's online libertarian folk hero. We are also going to ask the question, if murders in the United States are dropping and nobody cares, are they really falling? All that and your emails. Heaton, you're there for a wedding.
I'm here for a wedding, yeah. And then I'm meeting up with you later for a conference in Liverpool.
For a conference in Liverpool. Yeah.
And your wedding is on a Wednesday, if I got that correct?
It's on a Wednesday in late fucking October.
Yeah.
Hepburn. I would love to, because you know what would have been great? If when I was over here this summer, the wedding had been then. You know where the weather's terrific and everybody wants to be in Edinburgh, and I already had all my lodging taken care of? That would have been a great time. I don't know what they're up to. I don't know why late October was when they decided to do it, but I kind of messed up my schedule because I had to go over there for like, I would have just been there for 3 months and then come home and everything would have been hunky dory. But as it is, I'm going back and forth.
Wednesday, or as it's called derisively, the Scottish Saturday.
Yeah. I'm back here. Gonna don my kilt tomorrow and go to the wedding. I have a kilt jacket. Very excited about this development. I've never had a kilt jacket before, but I've now got a Scottish jacket.
That's pretty good. How often, you know, I think we probably all have a similar situations that there was like a prime time for weddings where like all of my friends were getting married from like a period of when I was like 25 to 32. I felt like I was going to like two weddings a year. On a pretty steady pace. Was
I'm
that the
still
same for
in
you
it.
Guys? You're still there.
Yeah, I hang with a younger crowd, so I feel like it started for me when I was like 35, and it's still going.
Oh wow, Heaton.
I think it comes in waves. There was a we're graduating college. Let's get married. Wave.
Okay,
that happened. That was mixed success in my estimation. Then there was a
some people doing it just to do it.
Yeah, we're definitely on our round of second weddings.
I would say that had about a 50% success rate, based on my estimation. And then there was an oh shit, we're 30 wave.
Yeah.
Now I'm approaching the, well, I guess we're 40 wave. So I suppose there'll be like kind of a little ripple coming up.
Would you say that the weddings are getting bigger or smaller?
Oh, they're getting smaller, like for sure. Because like, I've never been married, but like even talking to gals that I'm dating that are my age, we look at this and we're like, people listening, it boggles my mind that a wedding would cost $18,000 to $30,000, but I think like $18,000 is like the going rate in America or something, like it's crazy, right?
Spoiler alert, and if you want anything and you give wind that this is, that the W word is next to it, it immediately inflates four times in price. Like anything.
Yeah.
If you want extension cords, they're four times more expensive if you are needed for a wedding.
Yeah. Well, like so it's kind of it's a huge amount of money, and I'm aware of money now in a way that I wasn't when I was 23. When I was 23 and still had like many, many umbilical cords to my family that are now severed financially, it's just a number.
Yeah.
And it's a great big date. Whereas now I'm like, Jesus Christ, $20,000. We could really use that for something. And then the other bit is like, I don't need a toaster at this point in my life. Like I think wedding presents make a lot of sense when you're like 19 and you're forming a household with somebody else. But like two 40-year-olds getting together, they have to drop shit. Yeah. Like if anything, just rent a U-Haul for them. So like I'll talk to the friends my age now that are getting married basically want to elope and are pressured into a wedding on behalf of their parents. That seems to be what's going on now, is most of my friends want to do like 20 people and they agree to do more because their parents want to do something with them.
Yeah, our wedding was dictated by what parents wanted for sure. It's funny because like you think the wedding is like your special day, but like nope, it's all about the family. Yeah, it's not really about you.
And I can see it from their perspective, because they're more invested in you than you are.
For sure.
You're just kind of along for the ride, but your parents have watched this movie for decades at that point.
And literally invested. Like, they had to pay for my ass for a long time.
They were into it.
So they deserve a party.
I think part of the thing with the guest list is that when you're 20, you're pretty sure that you have, like, 30 best friends. Because you have like people you knew in high school and people you might have met in college or at work. And you're like, should we invite the dog sitter? Like there's just a lot of like, I don't know. These people could be with me for the rest of my life. By the time you hit 40, it's like a D&D party. I got five people. I got an archer. I got a ranger. I have a cleric. And like, other than that, I don't need anybody else. I got people that I thought were best friends back in the day. And since things have happened, but you don't need much.
Also, I'm curious. Can I, as fellow performers, entertainers, personalities, whatever, I would love to solicit your input on this. My friend Kevin. He is getting married, and he is trying. He's trying to scale this down as rapidly as he can, and I think that his fiance is with him on that. But I know both of his fiance and him are good friends of mine through improv. And Kevin's theory was that a lot of that I want to be a princess, I want to be a prince, like this day is about me stuff comes from a place of people that don't have an outlet for performing on a regular basis, that aren't the center of attention all the time. But for people that are performers like him, like me, potentially like you guys, his theory was that it's less important for us to have a big pay attention to me moment, since we get that in little bites throughout our lives. I don't know. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm the wrong person to ask, because my wedding ceremony was a performance that was held at Dragon Con. So that I would be the wrong person to ask with that particular situation. But I don't know. I know people that have gone different directions. Also, when it comes to comedians, you're also dealing with different personality types, because very often people that are extraordinarily exuberant on stage are kind of morose in their in their personal lives, and so maybe a more low-key affair would actually match their real personality and not their stage personality.
And I think there's something to that. I mean, I got married before I was doing any kind of performance, and I think it explains a lot about me that my wedding was one of the most awkward experiences of my life, because everyone was paying attention to me, and just in general in my life, if everyone was paying attention to me, it was a bad thing. So I didn't love it, but then I also have friends that, I mean, bridezillas are a thing, right? Where it's like, this is my day. And like, they want the whole bar to cheer for them when we walk in. So therefore we must wear giant princess dresses. And there is a thing where it's like, this is one day where I get to call the shots and be so extra. And everyone has to make these ridiculous fantasies of mine happen. And I do think there is a part of that where someone who leads like a very normal life is like, okay, I get to be so extra and my friends have to do the crazy thing with me. I think it's all in good fun and I love it, but I do think there is something to that.
One of my friends back when I was in college was telling me about her wedding ceremony that she was planning, and she went I want it to be simple. It's about me and about my husband. I don't want a lot of bells and whistles. I want my bridesmaids to carry an open bird cages as they approach the aisle to signify. And I was like, up, bells and whistles. That's
yeah.
We're going to have them do art where they're going to have gilded cages coming in. Yeah.
Hmm. Well, maybe we can sort this out down Argentina way. In a surprising turn of events this week, Argentina's general election, the ruling Peronist coalition led by economy minister Sergio Massa surpassed expectations and secured a lead in first ballot voting, setting the stage for a runoff scheduled next month. Massa clinched 36.6% of the vote, outperforming the person who was initially assumed to lead the voting, online libertarian folk hero Javier Milei, who garnered just over 30%. Now, if you are unfamiliar with our subject here, Javier, he grew up in a violent home, son of a bus driver, turned into a transportation entrepreneur. He is known for his ultra-libertarian stance. His rise to popularity has been led to a phenomenon, has been called a Milei quake, by an investor report by JP Morgan Chase, because they believe he could be that potentially disruptive to the economy of Argentina. He has served as a federal deputy of Buenos Aires and led the political coalition La Libertad Avanza. Before entering politics, Milei was an economist and a professor. He began leading a national think tank in 2012. He is known for his wild hair and combative image, including his love of dogs. When accused by a political rival that all he did was sleep in a bed with 8 dogs and his sister, he responded, "I only have 5 dogs." He loved his dogs so much that he cloned one of his dogs for $50,000. And that is the eccentric part of Milei. He has seriously proposed to dollarize the economy and currency controls, close the Central Argentinian Bank, and cut state spending sharply. He also favors laxer gun controls and tighter rules on abortion. Now, this does come at a time when inflation in Argentina is double digits. So there is a lot of economic pain happening in the country right now that has led to a large tranche of support for Milei. He has a battle cry. The cast is frightened. And in one of his political speeches, he says, "Remember, a different Argentina is possible with the same people as always, but the same people have always failed." Heaton, I'm sure that you have heard of Milei. He has become a folk hero to the online libertarian crowd. So we can start wherever you want. What are your general thoughts of him and his candidacy? And do you think that the lionization of these kinds of foreign politicians that are often very colorful is a good or helpful thing for the American public?
I think the lionization of politicians in general is a bad thing. I do not think that trying to turn in what should essentially be a proceduralist and bureaucrat and turning them into hero characters is something that's very useful, because it ends up giving too much credence to somebody that ought to be rightly viewed as a public servant and as a minimal force in the world. So like with Javier, the bits I like are that he's an economics professor, he's an Austrian economist. That bit I like. I think that's actually really good, and based on I'll preface this. I am not an expert in Argentina, but based on my cursory research into the Argentinian economy, I think that an Austrian economist coming mm-hmm. in and changing stuff is a really good thing. The stuff that gives me pause is the cult of personality stuff. That stuff kind of bothers me, because that makes me go, all right, how much of this is – like, let me put this way. If this were a tepid, problem-solving economics professor that loved dogs, I would be all about it.
Yes.
That sounds terrific to me. What I see,
therefore,
is
preventing him having any connection to the people and yes. precluding him from ever winning an election.
Yes, all true, all true. the bits that concern me, I always get concerned with polemicists. He's definitely a polemicist.
Yes,
I mean he's and I don't like polemicists regardless of where they're coming from, even if I agree with their economics. I also I struggle to read exactly what he is, and I think that this is something that Americans should be very careful about, is trying to project our system onto mm-hmm. foreign systems. So, for example, I'm in the United Kingdom right now. When I talk to my conservative friends in America, they're generally rooting for the Tories, and they see the Tories as, you know, the Republicans across the aisle because or the, across the pond because they're the conservatives. And I'm like, no, not really. Like, if we're looking at it from a policy standpoint, like, the conservatives are basically Obama Democrats, and Labor is Bernie Sanders. Like, it's everything is on the left side of the aisle from the United States perspective. And even rhetorically and ideologically, the conservative party over here is not the same thing as it is in the United States. So I get real hesitant when we start looking at Latin America and South America, where I know far less, and saying this person is – I've seen him described as ultra-libertarian and far-right-wing libertarian. Far-right-wing libertarian doesn't even make any sense to me, because a libertarian would – cut like an ultra libertarian would be an anarchist, would be saying like drugs for everybody, heroin and vending machines.
And
like,
he is at times described as an anarcho-capitalist. Like he has at least that seems to be more of an indicator of at least the spectrum for which libertarian thought is put on.
He is describing himself as such. And if that's the case, then I can figure out where he's at. Where I start to get kind of confused is it looks to me like his VP is like a social conservative Catholic nationalist character from what I can tell. Like his VP is making comments about how like getting rid of the draft, you know, made the nation all the males in the nation crybabies or something like that. Now, like I can say like the draft is fairly antithetical to a libertarian position. So now I don't know, okay, is this a situation where the libertarian guy has to run with a conservative in order to build a coalition? And then I'll hear things like he's anti-LGBTQ, but I will read things like he wants to get out marriage is a contract between two people, the government shouldn't be involved.
Yeah.
Now, if that's what he thinks, great. I'm all in favor of that. And as a side note, marriage certificates in the United States started as a way to stop black and white people from marrying. Prior to that, it was just the domain of the churches. But like when I hear he's anti-LGBTQ, does that mean that either the foreign press or the American press is misinterpreting what he's saying as being anti-LGBTQ, or is he anti-LGBTQ? And he is very free market in terms of economics, but he's very socially conservative. So it could be that he is a Reagan-type character, where he's like very Catholic and very Christian socially and very free market when it comes to economics. I see indications of that because he, I think among other things, says that God told him to run for president, which I take a rather dim view of. And I think his catchphrase is, like the front of heaven or something like that, which makes me a little concerned. So anyway, my overall point is it's hard for me to quite see what's going on. And I can't tell how much of this is populism masquerading as libertarianism, how much of this is libertarianism being misinterpreted by the press, so on and so forth. So I'm kind of holding my breath. All that being said, the economic part seems to be what he's running on primarily. The main things that he wants to do are get rid of the central bank and dollarize the economy and cut taxes and spending. As far as those things go, I think that the first two are a brilliant idea, and the third thing's probably a good idea. The inflation in Argentina is horrible. It's up there with Zimbabwe and Lebanon. It's one of the worst inflation economies in the world. I looked into this earlier today. A lot of countries are having similar inflation to the United States, which would indicate either A, that they're keying off of us because of their relationship to the dollar, or B, that something extraneous to the individual countries is driving up inflation. In their case, this started years before the pandemic, years before our current inflation woes happened. It's massive. Like I went through a calculator on this. Their currency's devalued by their prices have risen over the last 40 years by 272 billion. The pesos decreased by 140% over the last 40 years. Rent is rising by 50% a year. Interest rates are at like 138. Like, this is a really fucked up economy. Like, interest rates of 130. You guys remember when like the Fed raised interest rates by like 3%,
a quarter point. Yeah.
Yeah. From like 0 to 3. And like, and it had real, like for real effects. Like I can't buy a house now because it went up 3%, right?
Yeah.
It's 138% over there.
Just to give people a sense, in America, we hit, I think the highest point was on average 9% inflation, and then it kind of went down from there. Now, that's always a deceptive statistic because inflation never goes away. It just stops rising at the speed that it is.
Are we talking inflation or interest rates? Because he said 120 something interest rates.
So those are tied together. The central bank in America will raise interest rates to try to tamp down inflation.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is what they're doing. But they also, and I don't know the intricacies of the Argentinian back and forth politically. I don't know the factions there.
Yeah.
So I don't even know the groups that preceded them and whether they're considered conservative or progressive or what. But whoever's been running the show for the last 40 years has been really, 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 really irresponsible with their economy. They're printing money like crazy. Inflation is eating it up. It's really, really screwing over poor people. The way they try to fix inflation rather than printing money is to print more money and then institute price controls that don't work and then institute capital controls to try to keep money in the country, which ends up just forcing everybody to operate on a black market, which ends up pulling money out of their banks, which stops economic growth from happening. I mean, it's this massive fuck cluster that's going on over there. So getting rid of the central bank, getting the inflation under control, dollarizing the economy. It looks to me like Argentina already effectively has a dollarized economy because their currency is so horrible. People are illegally making big transactions in U.S. cash. They just don't want to report it at all. So both of those things make a lot of sense to me. I don't know a lot about their whole structure. I know that they've got a really high deficit to GDP ratio. And it would seem to me that based on cursory reading, Argentina has a very, very robust social safety net, but has not developed the economy large enough to pay for it.
So Sue's a point. And,
a prerequisite of redistributing the economy is you have to have an economy. So I think he might be well to cut government services and things if all they're doing is basically paying for it through inflation, which is just a backwards tax on the poor. I don't think they'd be any worse off for doing that. So all of that stuff makes sense to me. The cult of personality, that scares me a little bit. And there's a part of me, I can't quite tell if he's just a libertarian who happens to be Christian or if he's actually a Reagan character or if he would get into power and suddenly go like the military or something like that. Yeah. I have a poor read on that.
Jen, before we get into your thoughts, how much would you pay to clone your dog, Abby? He paid $50,000, so.
Wow, that's a lot.
$50,000, yeah. Especially we don't know whether it was in Argentinian pesos or that's just an inflated number, but the report is $50,000. Are you going to $50,000? I'm the dog cloner.
I mean, I found this dog on a bike path. Yeah. So, I mean, I like her and all, but I...
$50. Take it or leave it. This is my lowest offer.
I guess I'd pay 50. I feel terrible because I'm going to sound like I don't love my dog. I love my dog, but she holds us back in our travels. Uh-oh. So we have a whole list of things that we're going to do.
This is it, though. This is I'm just into cloning dogs. I want practice.
I would clone the dog and give it to one of you guys because I see you guys all the time, so I would at least get to visit Abby's clone. I would be down with that.
I'm taking your zombie dog. I already have a dog.
No, sorry, that's gross.
My zombie dog would be the best dog. She is so easy.
This is why I wouldn't clone a dog for two reasons. One, it's my understanding their personalities do change because a lot of celebrities have done this. Like Martha Stewart's cloned a bunch of her dogs and things like that. And apparently, like I don't know why, but like some kind of thing happens. So the dogs aren't the same dogs.
Yeah.
And I feel like if you've had a really good dog and that dog's had a really good life. Congratulations! Like that
I feel is like this is a soft way to get into a lot of theological discussions on the difference between
the other bit
body.
Too is that
did you ever see the movie Multiplicity?
Yeah,
that's kind of where, that's what I think. Like I would just end up with a dog even dumber than mine, and I just don't think that
I need a copy. No, but that's a morality tale about not cloning too much.
Yeah, how about not clone at all?
I don't know. Things are going really good in the first act until. An inciting incident.
Until four.
Other people can use their discretionary income for whatever they'd like, but like if I had $50,000 in my dog budget, I think I would get a new dog and fall in love with that dog and like, I don't know, donate the rest to the ASPCA or something like that. Like I feel like it's a very, I don't know, it's an odd allocation of dog resources.
I'd spend $50,000 on a dog wedding.
I've considered taxidermying my dog when she goes. So she can be like a little actual pillow.
You don't stay in one place. Where on earth are you going to put a taxidermied version of your dog?
Storage unit.
You're going to taxidermy your dog so you can put it in a storage unit?
Well, when I take the stuff out of storage, she'll be with me. And then I can put it back.
Can't you leave it at your dad's place? I feel like
My dad actually would. I think he would like a taxidermy.
Keep your dog on a mantle.
This is a startling revelation for your personality.
I've actually looked into it.
This is a startling, chilling revelation. What do you think about Argentinian politics?
So I think the most fascinating part of all of this that I read is, because I know enough about South American politics to know that there was, especially in like the 1970s, 1980s, there was the Chicago School of Economics that went down there, and there was a huge backlash to the privatization of everything. And this guy, who looked like he was doing well in the primaries and then not so well yesterday,
he's still in the runoff. So
still in the runoff, but yeah. I guess, like, because I was listening to some podcasts from The Economist about him, so I went back into the summer, and they were pretty much speaking about this guy as if he had it in the bag. And so the election yesterday was a surprise, and I'm just surprised that it's a surprise, because when you have someone in South America who keeps talking about Milton Friedman, who's basically like the patron saint of libertarians, talks about him all the time, was running on privatizing everything, including their organ donation network. Like, basically pay for organs, which I just find, like, horrific in terms of privatization. He wanted to privatize all kinds of stuff. And yet, he wants to make abortion illegal, so you don't have that social freedom that a lot of people would take along with privatizations. He just seemed like a character. And I think when it comes to governing, you don't want a character. Like, I think we kind of learned in this country, maybe, we'll see, that the character of Trump wasn't great at governing.
South American politics loves characters.
Well, I know.
They are really into characters.
This guy was a soccer player, was it a rock band?
They are USA Network characters.
You can see why a character like that would do well in the primaries, and then when it comes close to, like, oh, wait, he's actually going to govern, let's look at what he wants to do, and it's a lot of these same policies that were absolutely hated from the 70s and 80s. I do think it's possible that people took us, because The Economist was like interviewing people in Argentina, and they were all talking about the economics. The fact that there were people that, with all of this inflation, depend on the government services that they get. So the idea of those going away got very real after that primary. So I think the economics, while he was running on it, also kind of bit him in the ass.
Well, I think he's going to win or lose based on it.
Yeah,
if he,
sure.
His argument is, this is going horribly. Our inflation is at a runaway pace that is not going to stop unless we make massive, drastic changes. And instead of trying to manage it, and that is essentially what the economy minister who was running against him, who did better in the first ballot, is saying, no, we can manage it. We can manage it to be better. And he is saying, no, we are going to rip off the Band-Aid. We are going to actually make the hard changes that we need to make so we can save Argentina. The only question is, you know, he had a conservative that ran third, Patricia Bullrich. She had 23.8. So now the question is, with a 6-point difference between these top two, where does that 23.8 go? And I think that was part of the reason why people have kind of just referred to him as somebody that, you know, has a really, really good shot, because I would imagine that the conservative would split more toward him. But then again, I don't know anything about Argentina beyond chimichurri.
I know they have great steak.
Can I ask? I don't know South American history.
You don't know chimichurri? Have you ever had chimichurri? Good chimichurri?
I don't know that. Did Argentina adopt Milton Friedman reforms? I honestly don't know the answer to this question. Like, I think that, like, Chile, I want to say, like, he was involved with. But did he go into Argentina?
There was a bunch of countries. It could be on the list. I'll have to look it up. But the shock therapy, economic shock therapy, was something that was done widely in South America in the 1970s. And it was not popular, because it sucks for regular people to have the services you have disappear. And that's exactly what he's promising. He's promising to take away subsidies, so the things that make your life more affordable. And the idea is, it's going to be very painful at first, but it'll pay off in the long run. And there's a lot of people who are like, fuck this pain. And also, for a lot of these places, it didn't pay off in the long run either. So I think there is a lot of learning of history that when you hear these same things that were done 50 years ago, not that long ago, when you hear someone talking about the same ideas, the same economists that those ideas are coming from. He talks about Milton Friedman all the time. I think when people in South America in particular hear that, alarm bells go off.
Well,
I would be like, right now, Like I said, rent is going up 50% every year. Like, that's a really, really high spike in rent. Inflation's crazy over there. Changing on a daily, it's increasing all the time. And it seems to me that in any situation like that, the people that get screwed are at the bottom. The people at the top are able to afford it. The people at the top are able to, they're getting wage increases to compensate for the inflation going on. But that's not happening for people at the bottom. So that massive inflation that's going on is basically a giant, giant tax that's forcing them into poverty. Like, right now, about 40% of Argentina's population is in poverty, as opposed to like 10% of the United States. So it would seem to me that the subsidy system that they have right now is not working. It is at best a Band-Aid for a much, much worse underlying economic engine. And so having somebody come in and go, we're going to slightly modify this economic system that has demonstrably failed, to me is not a winning argument. I would be very inclined to go with the Milton Friedman guy.
Well, he's not arguing for mild tweaks to the system. He's talking to radical privatizations. Yeah. Like, this isn't small things. And I think if you're someone who's receiving the subsidies, to see someone blaming the things that are keeping you afloat in this situation as the things that are the problem, it's like, oh, I'm suffering from all of this inflation. This is helping me buy food. This is helping me buy gas. And some guy says, well, I'm going to take that stuff away. I'm going to blame that for the inflation and not the central bank. Well, he is blaming the central bank too, but there's other things that contribute to inflation, including a global pandemic, that are a part of this. So to just say, like, oh, we're going to take away these things that are helping you live, I don't think that's a winning thing to run on. And I also don't know if it's going to help the economy that much to pull the rug out from under people who are already suffering economically.
We will certainly see. Sorry, Heaton, go.
I mean, the inflation did start well before the global economy started having inflation, and before the pandemic as well. I mean, that's something that is at least orthogonal to the current issues that we're facing. But again, I'd posit, like, if you want to have a robust social safety net like Scandinavia or something, you do have to have a robust economy to fund it. And Argentina doesn't have a robust economy to do it. So they're going to, like, if they want to have all these things, they have to be able to figure out how to pay for them. And right now what they're doing is they're paying for them by printing money, which devalues the currency for everybody.
Yeah.
But particularly hits the poor people. So it ends up they're basically just taxing all of the poor people through inflation to pay for things that they can't end up delivering. So that to me is, and then it keeps getting floated by IMF bailouts and things like that. Like, I don't, from where I'm at, if I were over there and I were suffering from inflation at that level and rent was going up 50%, I would want shock treatment. I would want something radically different than the current failing system.
I would want to nationalize dog cloning. I will say from afar, and I think that there are sometimes when a very reductive view from a faraway place can be helpful, there are often times that it can be very stupid. I'm reminded of the freak out that people had over the Italian prime minister, Giorgia Meloni, who, because she was on the more right flank. And again, this is the right flank of Italy, right? This is not the right flank of Alabama, but she was looked at as like, oh, the successor party to Mussolini. Like, there was just a lot of really weird, ugly stuff that kind of came out. And she's proven herself to be a fairly capable steward of the Italian nation, at least not far out of league with some of the other European leaders up till now, right? And so we'll see what happens going forward. That being said, if I just look at this from a faraway place, the thing that it reminds me the most of, these arguments, is Brexit. In that you have somebody that comes from the current system that says, we know this is bad. Trust us. The reforms that have up till this point, after several decades, not worked, give us one more chance and we're going to reform our way out of this problem. And then you had the radical option that was on the table of let's do the crazy thing. Let's actually make gigantic changes to it. And if the frustration is high enough, as it proved to be barely in the United Kingdom, and I think it might be more so in Argentina, politically, I swear, give me one more Band-Aid and we will stop the bleeding argument tends to be a vulnerable one. I don't know if it's a losing one. I don't know enough about these two issues. I'm sure that there are the international experts that will laugh at me for even making those comparisons. But if I just look at it from a political perspective, you are making the oppositional argument exciting, if not necessary, by acknowledging the problem and saying, no, but we need to be serious. One more reform, that'll do it. At least those are my thoughts.
Can I make a pitch?
Of course.
Jin, I think we should legalize private organ sales.
Oh, fuck.
May I tell you why?
Sure.
Well, two reasons. One, I really do think you own your own body. Uh-huh. All the stuff that we say from the pro-choice camp, I believe you own your own body. But beyond that, I'm a consequentialist, right? I don't want people dying from lack of organs. And in the few countries that have done this, you have far less deaths from people that aren't able to get organs in time. Because, you know, like right now, the only people that are donating kidneys are very rarely people are doing it out of sheer kindness, and they are saints, and they deserve all of the praise that they can get. Most people are doing it if they know somebody. A few people will enter like a swap where I will do it for your aunt if you do it for my daughter, but no one's doing it with any profit incentive. All those things should be maintained, by the way. But if you have the profit incentive, there are going to be more kidneys. There are going to be more organs. And at the end of the day, more people will be alive. And so even though it feels weird because it's putting a price on organs, I would rather have that uncomfort and at the same time have more people live and not die from lack of organs. At the end of the day, I want more organs rather than less that are being transferred to people who need them. And having a privatization of that, in addition to everything currently going on, would benefit that and move us that direction.
Audio listeners, I just want to point out that throughout that entire monologue, Jen was looking at Heaton as if while he was talking, he was also taking a shit on the floor. That was Jen's face. Please go on.
Yeah, I hate that idea. Love you. Hate your idea. And I just did an episode on our organ transplant network, and I have good news for you. Without having to sell organs, therefore only rich people survive, we actually have enough kidneys in the United States if our system wasn't already privatized. The management was privatized. It's a company called Unos. It's the only company that's ever gotten the...
I listened to the episode. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. And so therefore you know that a quarter of our kidneys are just not getting to where they need to go. And we have experts who are saying we actually have enough organs from people who die. We could actually take care of this whole problem if it was better managed, because UNOS wasn't managing it very well. There's also a bunch of different parts of the system that are not going after all the organs for their own financial reasons. We don't have to have a system where only the rich survive, which I think is what we would get from privatizing and selling organs.
Did you think I was saying that you couldn't give it away or you couldn't donate organs?
I think right now we have a system that is based off of, or it's supposed to be based off of, who needs it right now. It's based off of illness. It's not based on money. Sure. And that is far more ethical than selling organs. I can't believe we're having this conversation.
I think all that stuff's great. All of that stuff's wonderful. I want to keep that. And I want to add more organs. So people should absolutely donate organs. I think if you have the ability to sell an extra kidney, more people would do it.
Okay.
Out of question, are you for legalizing sex work? Do you want that to be illegal? Where do you fall on that?
Well, yeah, that's fine.
Okay. I think you own your body. You can do whatever you want with it. Your body's not a public trust. It's something you have.
Third way. I believe that organs should be federally regulated and no one should get an organ unless they are a member of patreon.com/wearmountwrong. I think the exclusive way that you can have access to a life-saving organ is if you give money to this Patreon, patreon.com/wearmountwrong. If you are a patron or if you want to become a patron, you have not only an audio version of an AMA that we did this weekend while Heaton was still in town, we were all in the same room, but you have a video version as well. That is up there, and that is exclusively for patrons. So why don't you head on over there right now, patreon.com/wearnotwrong. But wait, friends, there's more. You get a bonus episode each and every week, and this week it is about new statistics making us all ask the question, are millennials and Gen Z even if they become more conservative, have they started out from a point more liberal than any generation, and therefore, even if they drift rightward, would not fall in to the ideological basket of the Republican Party like their forefathers? We will debate that on our Patreon exclusive, patreon.com/we're not wrong. Let's swing back to the United States, shall we? The U.S. witnessed a significant drop in homicides in 2022 with an accelerated decline observed in 2023 per crime statistics in a LA Times article. This trend contrasts with the rise in crime during 2020 and 2021 attributed to the pandemic and lockdown. The FBI reports a 6% decline in homicides in 2022, surprising many crime experts. This decline extends beyond homicides as violent crime overall decreased, reverting to near 2019 levels. And so the question, why then is there a widely held perception that we are in a high crime wave? Some say anecdotes, vivid stories have more power than dry numbers, writes the LA Times, to shape how people view their world. And in the social media era, crimes anywhere can be just a click away. Quote pollster David Paliogos, director of the Suffolk University Polling Center. Every time there's a smash and grab, it just amplifies in people's minds that crime is out of control. Jen Briney, should America feel safer by the numbers?
I mean, I guess so. But at the same, I think there's a lot to the idea that anecdotes are what's making us feel unsafe. Because I don't feel like I'm afraid of being murdered, but I'm certainly afraid of being robbed, especially in a lot of big cities like where we used to live, Oakland and San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Like, I was pretty much nervous about my safety. I wasn't. I was told so we moved there in October of 2014. So my first birthday there was March of 2015. I went to a park and I brought a little grill. It was actually that same place where that lady
Barbecue Betty.
I brought a barbecue to the park where she yelled at black people for barbecuing and then everyone brought barbecues. Well, I brought a barbecue and a cop immediately came up to me and was like, well, you can't do this. And I said, oh, it's my birthday. And he said, okay, we're going to let it go because it wasn't charcoal. And while I was just sitting there, we ended up having a chat for like half an hour. He was super nice. And he told me, you know, you're new here. You need to know that eventually you will get punched in the face and get robbed. And I was like, oh, well, you're the cops. Aren't you supposed to do something about that? And he laughed and he was like, we wish we could. And he's like, but it happens very often. And so he gave me some tips. He said, never carry a purse. Everything's in your pocket. Like, I talked to him about my headphone strategy, which is that I have headphones in at all times when I was walking around. But a lot of times I didn't have anything in them. I just looked like, oh, I can't hear you. So if a nutty starts saying something to me, I can pretend that I didn't notice. But I'm still completely aware of my surroundings. And I always use those tips. And I was never robbed. And also when it came to my car, I never had anything visible. Like not so much as like an iPhone cord. There was never anything in it. And I think I drove into San Francisco once to pick up a friend from the hospital. But I never drove my car into that city and parked it. So, 6 years there, I got lucky, but pretty much everyone I know has been robbed in some way or another. You got robbed? Where? I got robbed
in my neighborhood. Oakland. Because Adams Point, which is a very nice area of Oakland, has the distinction of you can get on and off the highway without hitting a stoplight. You could just run street signs. And so that is less patrolled, obviously, than the more major thoroughfares. So somebody hopped out of the car. It was late. I was coming back from doing a show in Petaluma and guy hops out, has what I still to this day, I don't know was either a piece of pipe or a barrel of a gun.
You don't want to find out.
And it was adrenaline packed. Takes my phone. My phone had my wallet on it. I had a wallet case on my phone at the time. I ask him as he's getting in. I'm like, look, take the phone. Could you do me a favor? Because I had a flight the next morning. Could you do me a favor and drop my ID? Just drop it on the ground. His getaway driver, he thinks about it for a second. The getaway driver goes, no! And they get in the car and they drive off. Years later, I get a gigantic envelope from the county of Alameda. Somebody had been arrested, and in their house where they were arrested was my ID. And if I confirmed that it was my ID, he was going to get more time because it would be added on as a identity theft. There's identity theft laws. And so I said, I don't personally require any further punishment considering because he was facing a bunch of other crimes. But I would like it noted for the record. Should have dropped the ID.
Yeah. for sure.
I just want him to know you should have dropped the ID. I asked you. You didn't. That's fine.
But I think the boarded up window, and it's not just the Bay Area. I pick on the Bay Area a lot because I hated it. But I've been traveling all over the United States, and there are a lot of empty storefronts, streets that feel
blight.
Like that
should... Urban
yeah.
blight.
Streets that feel like they should be busy where there's no one there, and the people that are there are kind of sketchy. So I think that sketchy feeling just made... And it's, like I said, so many different cities I've felt that. And I generally, like, I'm not a scared person. I'm 6 feet tall, and I don't scare easily. But I've just had this vibe that I feel like I wasn't getting 10 years ago when I also traveled all over the United States. So I think it's a vibe thing.
The vibes are bad.
The vibes are bad.
The vibes are bad.
Yeah.
Heaton, you just fled the country. Do you think we should feel more safe here because of these numbers?
Yes, I do. I don't trust feelings. I trust math. And I think that this is not to refute anything that Jenner, you were saying, but I think that there is this a phenomenon that's been happening my entire lifetime. When I moved to New York back in 2011, like people back in Oklahoma, my parents were like, that's a very dangerous place. You should keep, you know, two wallets on you, a real wallet and a dummy wallet for when you inevitably get mugged. And I was looking at the stats and I was like, New York is the safest large city in America at the time. Mm-hmm. Like it had been dangerous in the 80s. It had gotten cleaned up. I never had a single problem when I was in New York City. I was there for 5 years. Perceptions persist a very long time. Like right now, there are people in my family that think of Missouri as a really safe part of the country, whereas New York is a very dangerous part of the country because in the 80s, the lower Bronx had burning trash cans and guys with fingerless gloves and knives, mm-hmm. whereas Missouri.
But they were also
America.
Singing doo-wop songs, which helps.
Yeah.
Maybe that was just in Philadelphia.
But like now you look at it what was the suburb that George Floyd died in? I can't remember. It's in
Paul.
Missouri, wasn't it?
Yeah, Minneapolis. Saint
Paul, was it
yeah.
in Minnesota?
Yeah.
Okay. It's like right outside of St. Louis, and St. Louis itself and even Dallas are like less safe than New York City is. At least they were 3 years ago. I also think that it's really difficult to make mental models of a country as large as we are, mm-hmm. because you could have a completely different set of circumstances in Scrumpox, Iowa, than you've got in downtown Michigan. And you're also going to get outliers. Like, it's my understanding that Washington, D.C. is increased in terms of violent crime the last 3 years. So if you're living in D.C., that is a thing, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be the same everywhere else. Like, right now I'm in the U.K. Imagine that we looked at just European violence as a whole, as opposed to looking at it country by country. Because my guess is that there's probably very different rates of violence in Bulgaria and in Norway.
Yeah,
but if we were to put them all together,
who do you think is more violent? Let's start a fight.
I think probably Bulgaria. And I think
and
they'd
why?
Probably agree with me.
Oh,
yeah,
that R,
a little swarthy, huh? Can't trust them. Bad stock.
No. Just lack of vitamin D in the north. That's all. Vitamin D is a prerequisite for violence. That's it. But a couple other things too. Like I think that this really gets to just a fundamental part of being human, which is that we suffer from cognitive tricks all the time. Evolution did not design us to accurately and objectively assess the universe in some sort of clear, undiluted distillate. That's never what the whole package was designed to do. The package is designed to get you to reproduce and not get eaten by a tiger. And that usually involves hypervigilance, overreactivity, and seeing patterns where there may not be one. Because it's evolutionarily, it's far more useful to be wrong about being cautious than it is to be wrong about being uncautious and get devoured by a tiger. You get devoured by a tiger once, you're screwed. You panic several times, you're okay. So we naturally gravitate towards things which are visceral and novel. Think about shark attacks. Like sharks literally eat 3 people a year. They don't even eat them. They spit them out. We don't taste good to sharks. They don't like us. They kill about 3 people a year that they think are seals. They bite their leg off and then they go, blah, 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 blah. They spit them out. and the person bleeds to death. It's very sad, but we're talking about 3 people a year. Sharks kill way less people than dogs that I love, or mosquitoes, which is the greatest enemy mankind has ever had. Mosquito is our biggest arch nemesis. I'm from Oklahoma. I should be way more concerned about diabetes than terrorists. It is so much more likely that a hamburger is going to kill me than a terrorist will. And yet, if you were to go to Oklahoma and ask people, you know, what are you more afraid of? Terrorists coming in and killing you or a hamburger? I think that people would generally say that they would rank diabetes demonstrably dangerous where I'm
but
from.
Also, that's because a terrorist has never delighted you in the midday with a side of fries. if that were the case, then people would have less hard feelings about it.
I think that we end up, I think we very naturally end up creating a world where we are attracted to things that are visceral, scary, and novel. And by definition, the things that are novel are not emblematic of the world itself. And so I think that it's very important to pay attention to these numbers. The other thing I'll add is I've got a pet theory. I don't know how to prove this, but I think that as people get older, they become more cautious. I think that we naturally build a kind of mental scar tissue because we remember all the bad things that we've seen or have happened to our friends over time. So I think basically as countries get older, they think that crime is going up. I think that you're 70 years old and you remember the time you got mugged when you were 35 and your aunt got burgled 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And you extrapolate all these things as a model of the entire world because you're looking at such a long collection of data that it may not actually be representative and generally isn't. And so I think that the longer basically the population lives, which is a good thing, the more likely we are to think that it's also becoming more crime ridden.
Well, I mean, if you want the numbers to match the vibes in terms of murders, all you have to do is legalize Andrew Heaton's idea of selling organs for profit and incentivize more murder. And then we can have that match.
So the Heaton option is you can do whatever you want with your organs, just to be very clear on this. If you want to sell them, sell them. If you want to donate them, donate them. Absolutely fine.
Let's talk about the numbers. Because I do think that the way that this article was written, I found a little dishonest in that it conflated two different things. It conflated murder statistics with public perception of crime, which while they are related, they are not the same.
Yeah.
Nor did it cite smash and grabs or property crimes, stuff like that.
Getting punched in the face.
Those are different things, and I don't think that we necessarily can say that they are the exact same. The second thing that I found odd about the shaping of this was that it was presented in the idea of, shouldn't we all feel really good? Why are we so worried about crime when these murder statistics are now at 2019 levels? That's one way to look at it. The way that I would choose to look at it is, thank God we are at the end of a 3-year reign of terror that was largely brought on by unemployment and lockdowns.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not here to make an argument against lockdowns or government intervention, however strong or light you felt that it was in your locality. Various things can change. But I don't think that anybody would make an argument that they were not correlative with murder, that high unemployment, even if it was only for, you know, the several months that it was at, you know, we cosplayed as the Great Depression for like 2 months and then we wound up beginning to get back to normal, that didn't have an effect, especially when you take out a lot of frontline jobs in a lot of areas of the country that were taking the coronavirus extraordinarily seriously, and they reduced a lot of jobs that would be entry-level jobs, let's say, therefore forcing people into areas that they might not otherwise be in, some of that the drug trade, which creates a lot of the murders that we saw during the pandemic. So I'm here for all the stats. I'm not challenging them. I know that there are some that would say that there is a correlation between a lack of police recruiting and or funding to that these numbers are not accurate because we are not reporting them appropriately. But let's leave that to the side for now. Let's take them as gospel. All we are saying is that we are just now getting back to the level that we were before the lockdowns. And I mostly care about that lesson just so if and when we have another scenario wherein we have the same kind of situation that we had in 2020, I think that we should include these ideas, that we should involve the fact that, hey, if we shut things down and we put a lot of people out of work, the murder rate goes up. And the murder rate doesn't go back down to pre-levels until 3 years after. I just think that I'm not saying that it should be the operative way that we decide things, but I don't want it to be pushed off to the side.
Well, it's good to remember, and I think you've really picked up on something that I've noticed, but you just articulated, which is that we're seeing a lot of, we're doing great, we're back to 2019 levels. And it's like, okay, so we're back to the status quo. Was that great to begin with? There's like, yeah, things are going down, but we're going down to a point that like.
It just means that we recovered from the cure.
Yeah.
We are now running the same speed that we did before chemo.
Like that's, exactly.
And that's great. Great for us. Yeah. Right. We bounced back.
Before chemo, yeah. I was fat and like I wasn't exactly healthy to begin with. So, yeah, it's. Yeah,
you guys make good points, and I wish. Thank you for making those points, in particular, Justin. I wish I'd brought that up. That was the thing that I found specious about that argument, was it was talking about like this is the lowest rate or the highest rate of decline in murder, you know, in 50 years or something like that. But the immediate question you should follow up with is, yeah, compared to what?
Yeah,
they were looking at it like crime has decreased by 20%. Or murders decreased by 20% this year. That is a leading statement. The best way to do that would be looking at like a timeline of the last 20 years and how are we compared to the last 20 years. I agree on that. By the way, you can manipulate statistics, and we should definitely keep an eye on that. My main point was just that I tend to err more on empiricism.
You're not there for vibes. Vibes should not be the leading argument.
I think the vibes can actually be pretty useful in that, like, I think a lot of the economy does key off of vibes and a lot of like, you know, where am I going to move to, or where am I going to open up a business? I think that is vibe related. Right.
Yeah.
It's more like how good or bad is the universe based off of the anecdotes my friends have told me. That's the thing that I'm very critical of.
Well, like the stock market's all about vibes. Like, do we have faith in the stock market and like all of the happy talk that comes out of the Fed all the time to make sure that the markets aren't spooked. Like, it's so vibe based.
Yeah,
it is very vibe based. That's one of those things where I've spoken to a few economists about this, because it's always it was very difficult for me, and still is, to like, when the economy gets better, it's like, okay, is this something smart from two presidents ago that's kicking in now? Yeah. Or is this something that the current president did this week? And the answer that I've heard that makes sense to me is that when we're looking at unemployment rates, that's probably a long-term arc. When we're looking at stock market is spirit animals. It's spooks and happiness and things like that. So the stock market is very vibe-based. What I was cycling through, guys, was all the conversations I've had with people where I have to go, no, the world is not going to shit because your cousin got burgled in Oakland. I'm pushing against anecdote.
Yeah, and I do think that that's a really, really good argument. I mean, I know... I think I enjoyed my time in the Bay Area a little bit more than you did by the time that you left, Jen. But that was something for which, when I was traveling for business, you just faced a lot of doom and gloom. A lot of people who, if they were, you could tell if they listened to conservative radio or watched Fox News, that the first thing that they said as soon as you mentioned San Francisco or the Bay Area, it was shit on the street. That was the number one thing.
People There's a lot loved, of shit on the street.
People loved talking about shit on the street. And indeed, that was my favorite game to play in the mission when I would walk to work, human or dog.
Yeah.
But it was not the totality of the place. And personally, in my life in Oakland, I did not see a lot of shit on the street. So it did not define my existence, even if statistically it was larger. And that means everybody sees things from their own perspective. What I think tends to be interesting in this particular moment is that saying, oh, we've had the biggest fall in murders over the last 2 years, aren't we doing great, is the same as saying, wow, we've seen the biggest spike in employment over the last 3 years. It's like, Yes.
Which is what Biden's
we
saying.
We shut down the economy. We followed the tried and true way that you solve tech problems. We turned it off and turned it back on again and hoped that everything was going to be better. Like, yes, you're going to see a large spike in crimes when people don't have a way to make money. Yes, you're going to see a large spike in employment when all of a sudden everybody has the opportunity to fire everybody. So it's like, you know, it's I would just say to the dear listeners who enjoy this show, just be careful about those kinds. It reminds me whenever there's a new television network or some new thing, they'll be like, wow, year on year, we've grown 300%. And it's like, yes, you went from 3 people to 3,000 people. You should be very, very excited about your growth.
Well, and Bidenomics is basically, we're not in a pandemic anymore. And they're running on it. And it's like, I don't know if that's really going to play.
Well, according to polling in the swing states, it's not. it is not playing. It turns out that just saying no, everything's fine is not great when people are taking things out of their grocery cart because they realize they can't afford it at the checkout. So there's that. Hey, let's talk about some emails. We're not wrongpod@gmail.com. There are 4 lights. We're not wrongpod@gmail.com. I got a Star Wars thing in there for you. How I Met Your Pundit writes, I've come to realize that Heaton is Barney Stinson if you swapped his charisma and wisdom stats.
Thank you. I love you.
Barney.
I like that character. I'll take that. And I feel like he was high on both of them. Also, lots of suits and like getting laid. So
exactly. Summary of Jen on AI writes, deep fake porn is fine, but watch out for Age of Ultron.
Did I say deep fake porn was fine? I don't remember. We
talked about this like a year ago, but I don't even remember what the hot takes on deepfake were.
I think that was a while ago. That was even, I think, before we got to our modern, like, I think it was pre-ChatGPT that we even had that conversation. And that was a Twitch streamer that was found when they went to their desktop. Somebody spotted a tab that showed another streamer. It was deep fake porn of another streamer. So they basically just put the other streamer's face on already made pornography. And that was what that was.
Should I be weirded out at all that this listener remembers my take on deep fake porn and I don't?
I think
you should only be weirded out if they're one of the listeners that was sending us like softcore gen AI picks for the calendar that
to make it right, the listener should send in deep fake porn of themselves to Jen exclusively. Mm.
Actually, not at all. Please don't encourage that, Jen.
what HR person could get mad at that?
No, don't worry. Send it to me. I'll send it to Jen. AI. I don't like it, writes. I think we should be more concerned about what people, or let's be honest, corporations, will choose to allow AI to assume without adequate supervision. Long before AI kills us all, there will be continued wage disparity and divide as both skilled and unskilled labor gets moved over to AI provided. At the same time, quality in the AI controlled tasks will diminish, but companies won't care because the stock price will be up. These corporate fat cats.
I mean, an example of what you're talking about would be nice. I can't think of anything offhand.
The corporations. How about that for an example? These CEOs and their fat cat lifestyles with their wage theft and their mistresses. They don't care. They're fat cats. Just rolling around.
It's that thing that Heaton hates where it's like, corporation's bad.
I do hate that. I got 2 things on this. I think part of this is there's just two very different approaches towards risk. One is a permission-based system and one is an innovation-based system. If you're an innovation-based system, you innovate and the supervision comes on the back end. If something bad starts to happen, then we get involved in it. The other one is a permission-based system where you ask permission before you innovate. There are good and bad elements to both of this. I am very much on the innovation side. It sounds like our listeners more on the risk aversion side. So far as the wage disparity goes, we got a lot of good feedback on AI, and several people wrote to me individually on AI since I was kind of the most Pollyanna about it last week. And it seems to me that there are kind of like three arguments that tend to go around in terms of AI. One is that it will exacerbate inequality. One is that it will automate all the jobs. And then the other one is Terminator in some capacity, yeah. Right?
By the way, we have a lot of AI emails here. So
yeah. Just to hit on the inequality thing, the automation thing I don't think is going to happen because just every time we develop new technology, it ends up creating more jobs than it gets rid of. And as far as the inequality goes, yes, that is probably going to happen. You are probably going to see inequality result from big economic growth because they tend to go hand in hand. Economic growth does not tend to come at an egalitarian pace, but when it's working well, everybody benefits, but everybody's benefiting at a different time. So we'll all be getting more money, but the rich will be getting even more than that. I personally would rather have everybody get richer and have inequality increase than the other way around. A lot of people would beg to differ.
I will say that at least at this point, the industries that look the most ripe for disruption are not the lower wage industries.
Yeah.
They are the higher wage industries. We are in the doctors and lawyers class more than the Amazon assembly worker class. And so I would not worry so much. I'd worry about physical automation, like robots and stuff like that. If you are in a standard wage job, I would very much be looking over my shoulder if, let's say, I was going into a career in law or medicine. I would be looking very much at how AI can augment and how that can be a part of my career, because I think the laziest of the lawyers, the laziest of the doctors that are there because they have done the thing and they spent their money on their loans and they set up their shingle and they interned or whatever, those guys are going to get hit. Because I think that we're already establishing over the last year a pattern of, now I can just ask basic general questions in these fields to a computer and I feel pretty good about the answers that it's given me, because when I double check with a professional, they tell me the same thing. And I only think that's going to get bigger and more intense going forward.
I hope what this means at the end of all of it, like the path we're on, is the path that we've been promised for a long time, is that if we keep automating things, that at some point humans won't have to be working ourselves to death the way we do now, that we will have more free time, that we won't have to work 5 days a week. Maybe we can go down to 3 or 4. I'm hoping that what happens is you pay humans to do less work. And I just think it would be better for all of us if that's how this goes, instead of having some people be employed fully and then other people just like robbing you on the street. I think we need to find a balance for our society, and it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. But that's my hope for all of it.
Prepare Your Brain writes, imagine Heaton's favorite mental model, a four-square diagram for the future of artificial general intelligence, AGI. And so this is something for people who are new to this conversation. When you talk about the kind of AI that we have seen in movies and television shows that we've created our myths around, the thing that learns, that is what is referred to as AGI. And we do not have AGI currently. But if we are on the road to it, one side in this four square diagram is proximity, ranging from this decade to our lifetime's end. The other side deals with the speed of development once it starts, whether it's all at once or steady throughout the decade. The second axis is really the one that matters. Fast takeoff, depicted in science fiction by the concept of a singularity, is far riskier than slow takeoff, irrespective of how soon it happens. Given that comparison, present efforts in AI research give us more time to address dangers before AGI becomes a reality. But doesn't working on AI now make fast takeoff more likely? The current AI systems, while advanced, are nowhere near the capabilities of true general intelligence. Compute limitations currently act as a bottleneck for training these systems, and numerous fundamental breakdowns are needed before they become existentially risky. It's better for the tech industry to invest time, effort, and resources into understanding AI's impact before more accessible computing and further AI advancements come into play.
Hey, listener, thank you for speaking, Heaton. I really appreciate that you were engaging in mental models in order to help me on here. I know we've got a couple of AI comments about the potential downsides of this. So let me just say this from where I'm coming at, because I'm openly soliciting feedback from you, audience. You can send it to Justin or to me, given that we're not doing email stuff, right?
But do send AI-generated porn of yourself to Heaton as well.
Yeah. Do that too. I'm always taking that. The third thing I mentioned of, like, you know, the first two were like inequality and automation. I'm not worried about those two things. The third one is kind of the Terminator scenario. But when I start hearing people from this perspective, it tends to be something near the lines of AI could be really big, really fast, and that scares me. And it doesn't really scare me that much. But if you were to give me like a specific thing, like not the size or speed of it, which are kind of vague to me and very general, but this is the thing that could happen. We have to be worried about X, this specific thing. That would be very helpful to me. Because at the moment, there's a ton of really smart people who are far smarter than me that are really worried about AI. And just the more I read about it, the less worried I am. So I feel like I'm missing something. But the generalities aren't getting me there.
Known Unknowns writes, Justin, you are right. A basic working of neural networks are not complicated. Given a set of inputs, it returns an output. No more complicated than what we were doing in Algebra 2 in high school. However, it is unbelievably complex. Trillions of these inputs and outputs coalesce into one predicted result. It is practically impossible for a human to reproduce in an effort to explain exactly how a neural network comes up with the results it does. Developing tools and methodologies for explainability is a huge field in machine learning and AI right now, because it can be very difficult to determine why an LLM came by the results that it did. It's this lack of explainability that creates what Jen and other downwingers fear, rightfully, because the inner workings of an LLM are still somewhat mysterious. As we all know, it often yields surprising and at times unexpected results. Who was to say that such a result, given enough influence, couldn't be dangerous or against the progress of humanity? No one. And that is all, to my understanding of these technologies, absolutely true. We know in general, you put a bunch of stuff in, you train it to be a better prediction machine, and at a certain point, with enough tweaks, it becomes a very good prediction machine. And that's essentially what we are looking at now. But we don't know how. We don't know what is going on and what it is using to match things. So there we go. A little bit of settle down for my optimism. Am I real? Did I write this? Writes, I was listening to you talk about how machines don't have thoughts and feelings. And my question for you is, what are thoughts and feelings? Are they not simply the result of neural impulses, i.e. electric signals? And if they arouse naturally in organic matter to create all life, why couldn't they happen naturally again in AI? How can we know for sure that we aren't creating sufficient conditions for this?
Exactly.
This is a fascinating question that gets to the nature of what is intelligence. There's a great book called The Three-Body Problem, which was, I think, a Nebula Award winner and written by a Chinese national. So a good opportunity for anybody that wants to read sci-fi from outside of the United States. And there's a thought experiment at one point where people are conducting computer equations through flags, because computers are switches, right? That's what the ones and the zeros are. It's a series of binary equations. And they basically get an army together, like a massive million-man army of people with flags, and they're able to create this, like, 18th-century computer using people and flags. I look at that and go, I think you can add as many flags as you want. The combination of flags is never going to be an intelligence, because it's just information. There's some sort of additional hardware that needs to be there. But then again, I'm having to key off of a Chinese science fiction novel to get there. So there could very well be more to this that I don't understand at all.
Darmok is memes writes, Jen mentioned the question that her her table cleaning robot was a person. As a fellow Star Trek nerd, I'm offended that Heaton didn't mention the classic TNG episode Measure of a Man, where Captain Picard defends Data in proving that he is both a machine and a person.
Guys, getting Jen to watch Star Trek is a long, soft, nuanced project of mine. Okay. Damn. Let's not just like spook her right out the gate. We gotta bring her into this. Also, Data is a fucking person, and Jen's table cleaning robot isn't a person. If that were getting interrogated by the Admiral from The Measure of a Man, everybody would have concluded that that robot is just a robot, not a person.
Just so you know, this email is the one I read because it was a paragraph. We also got a 500-word breakdown of this episode and how it relates to the modern world.
Oh my God.
So, the Trek fans,
great.
When they come,
great.
They come hard.
Assemble, Trek fans, assemble.
Yeah, they make it so. 1090 what? Can someone explain why this IRS contractor even had access to tax returns in the first place? A major detail in IT security is that individuals should only be granted access to the permissions necessary to do their job. For example, you would never need to plug a USB drive for your job, then the USB drive simply shouldn't function. What exactly was his job as a consultant?
I don't know.
Yeah, I shouldn't have put this in here because I don't know. But
These are very good points, and I nominate this person to work security at the IRS.
You want to know what? I would encourage you to Google it.
Yeah, I would encourage you to write in and let us know. Yeah. That would be helpful.
Yeah.
What exactly. Are we, your research
this
monkeys?
Is it my problem? This is your problem. Disgusting writes, I, for one, find Justin's blatant affinity for magic deeply disturbing. It's clear evidence that his relationship with Brian Brushwood and Andrew Main, both infamous magic deviants, have gone too far. Please understand, friend, that I find magic disgusting. It is a weird trade that is only plied by absolute lunatics. I feel like I've often found every cool person in magic, but I look at myself more as a rescuer. You know, I'm like the Operation Underground Railroad, like the Sound of Freedom movie. But I'm rescuing people that otherwise have personalities from the clutches of magic.
You're a hero.
Thank you. Thank you for saying it. We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor, it's me this week. Well, Will's out in out of the continental United States. So it's me, baby.
Where's he? Where's Will? Is he in Edinburgh?
No.
Can I meet him?
He's in Hawaii.
Yeah, Will.
The Edinburgh of Polynesia.
Aloha, Will. Right. We miss you.
Heaton, what's on the orf?
Hold on a minute. Sorry, this is the jet lag and all that stuff.
No, we're keeping this in. Watch. His brain slowly frays like twine on overworked rope.
You know what? I've got a good one. Robert Sapolsky. Robert, this is going to piss off a bunch of people. I think this is going to be a real, like, my dad preemptively wrote me a nasty message about this guy. And I was like, hey, he's my guest this week. Robert Sapolsky, he's a neurologist from Stanford University or something akin to that, a neurobiologist or something like that. He's a brain guy. And he wrote a book on how free will doesn't exist. He is of the opinion that free will is an illusion, that we are misleading ourselves, believing that everybody is making their own decisions. And I'm less interested in this from a philosophical perspective. I'm more interested in the implications of this in criminal justice. If free will really isn't a thing, should punitive measures really even be a part of criminal justice, or should it be completely protective and rehabilitative? So I talked to him about that. It is an episode that really gets into some fascinating conversations about the nature of consciousness and also a lot of neurology. I ask him a lot of questions about, like, what's testosterone do? If I get more testosterone, will I fight Justin? And stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So that's on the Political Orphanage this week.
Just bring it, you fucking beanpole.
You know what he told me?
Yeah, what?
Okay, so apparently when you give guys more testosterone, it's not that guys become more aggressive in general. They become more aggressive to people that they view as either subordinate or okay to push around. So let's say that Justin and I have a clearly hierarchical relationship, and Justin is the boss. More testosterone is not going to make me a dick to Justin. But if I live in a misogynist society where I'm allowed to be mean to women, I will be meaner to Jen. Or vice versa. If Jen's my supervisor and Justin's an intern, more testosterone won't affect my relationship with Jen, but it will affect my relationship with a subordinate.
A buddy of mine was on supplemental testosterone because he had what we eventually found out was a brain issue for him that was overproducing various different things. But for the moment, they thought that it was a testosterone shortage, and it just kind of made him a weird asshole. Like not in any kind of specific way, because he was, even today, he's a combative guy. Became a lawyer, shocker. But he would just be prone, especially while drinking, to just do weird shit. Like, my mom moved, or maybe she got new couches. So she sold my friends that all lived in this dude house together in college my old couches. And so one night, they're all sitting, they're watching, you know, God knows what is happening in aughts television. And my buddy just takes a knife, carves a hole in the couch, and puts his beer in it.
You know what? This is okay. Thing he told me is that it increases risk-taking behavior that is likely to result in like status or something like that. I was worried that I had low testosterone before I left Tulsa. I had a really cool doctor there. This, like, he'd been a prison doctor. His name was Dr. Barney. He was in his 90s. Like, we would just hang out for an hour and a half, whatever. I was like, hey, I think I'm kind of low in testosterone. And he was like, why do you think that? And I was like, I'm not very aggressive. I don't tend to fight. I'm not real assertive with other people. And he goes, maybe you're not an asshole. I was like, oh, great. And then, like, I came back for the follow-up on it. And he's like, your lipids are good. Your hemoglobin's good. Your testosterone's fine. Your lady friends won't be able to walk. Now, how are you doing in terms of it? He just, like, started saying this other stuff. It was just very odd. I was like, oh, thanks. Thanks, Doc.
Good.
I like Dr. Barney.
He's a great guy. Love Dr. Barney. I miss that dude.
Jen.
We dropped the digital dollar episode on Congressional Dish. And people are loving it because this topic is so off of everybody's radar. So, yeah, the Fed is thinking about making a form of digital cash, which I will tell you doesn't look a lot like cash to me. And so it's really a highlight of the debate that's happening in Congress and not happening on C-SPAN. So this is one of those. It's your favorite type of episode, Justin, where it's like deep into the Congress where no one watches, an empty room.
It's so funny because it's like there's been this viral video going around about how Michael Jackson didn't really have a high voice when he was talking in private.
Really?
That he had more of a flat monotone kind of voice, and that was sort of affected for his public persona. And that's what I feel about those episodes, because you just hear all these voices that you've heard in politics forever, a lot of them big names. But they're actual humans.
They're behaving themselves.
They're like, Ted Cruz is like, so if the water main bleeds off into the drainage ditch, isn't that going to get people sick? It's like, it's not a gigantic thing where everything needs to tie into a Fox News or MSNBC talking point. That people are actually asking interesting questions.
Well, and I know this from now being an insider in C-SPAN, having been on it three whole times. But I did talk to them, and they have camera crews. C-SPAN has three camera crews that goes into the hearings, and they bring giant cameras. And so the people in Congress know when C-SPAN is there. They know when they're going to get TV time, and the nature of those hearings are very different. Because otherwise, they know that these hearings are either going on YouTube, or if it's in the Senate, they're not even on YouTube. They're just on the committee websites, and there is no counter on those. But even this one, which was actually watched more than a lot of the others, only had 3,000 views when I made the episode, which means that I'm going to expose it to far more people
than had already watched it.
Yeah. And that's
which were probably just all from World Economic Forum freakout message boards.
Yeah. I'm like, who are these 3,000
or cryptos
people?
Crypto bros and World Economic Forum freakouts. And there's a hefty gray of that Venn diagram.
Well, and I can tell you, if you are a crypto bro, this is worth your time, because that was discussed in the hearing. This idea is connected to crypto in a very real way, and so that's part of it too. So I love this episode. I think other people will too.
Excellent. On PX3 this week, we are going to be talking about a fascinating... Well, number one, we'll update you on the latest on the House, because that's its own... absolute twisted metal shit show. But
when you don't have a speaker, just give yourself a 4-day weekend. They're not
even
fat
until now.
So
they could have 19 people run. By the time that you listen to this, we'll have some kind of
we're down to 8
answer to it. And so we'll go from there. And then also an interesting fight between two DC organizations. One of them, No Labels, which wants to put an alternative candidate on the ballot in 2024, and the other, Third Way, a part of the Democratic coalition. They hate each other. And No Labels put out new polling that the third way says is proof that No Labels doesn't want to win an election. They can't win an election. Before, Third Way said they just wanted to spoil it for Trump. And they're still kind of saying that. But now they are saying, no, the point that No Labels really wants is to deny both Biden and Trump enough electoral votes, therefore making No Labels a House of Representatives kingmaker. So we will talk
about that. Oh, shit. It's like they're actually trying to win an election somehow. Whoa.
We'll go over all that. PX3. Oh, and Kevin Ryan's on talking about right-wing art because he just did a whole big thing on Richmond, north of Richmond, which you might think wasn't that 6 months ago. And you're right, but he's Kevin Ryan. And so it takes him a long time to process this, and it's usually well worth it on the other side. So listen to that episode on Friday. Till then, this is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, for Jen Briney and Andrew Heaton. Where? Not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.